Pacifica. This is Democracy Now!
We had a fantastic campaign, and the voters in the 2nd District won. We presented them a real choice. We're going to fight to keep up this good fight, and we're going to get it done here in the future.
An Iraq War veteran and Democratic candidate almost wins a closely watched, overwhelmingly Republican district. We'll speak with Ohio's Paul Hackett. Then, when the military co-opts civil society, today a debate on the CIA secretly supporting scholarships and the Pentagon partnering with the Peace Corps.
This blurs the long-standing independence of Peace Corps and potentially threatens the security of serving volunteers.
And the White House plan for Iraq.
U.S. casualties continue to mount as sectarian strife intensifies throughout Iraq. Is the Bush administration trying to provoke civil war as its exit strategy?
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 14 Marines and a civilian interpreter were killed early today in western Iraq, making it one of the deadliest days for U.S. forces in months. 7 more Marines died on Monday. The overall U.S. military death toll in Iraq has now topped 1,800, and the total number of coalition troops killed has passed 2,000. Meanwhile, a U.S. journalist named Stephen Vincent has been found murdered in the Iraqi city of Basra. He was shot 3 times in the chest. His killing comes just days after he published an op-ed in the New York Times criticizing the rise of Shia fundamentalism in Basra. Vincent was in Iraq as an unembedded freelance journalist. He'd published articles in the Wall Street Journal, Harper's National Review, and the Christian Science Monitor. He also ran a blog called The Red Zone and wrote a book entitled In the Red Zone. Vincent is believed to be the first U.S. journalist murdered in Iraq. His translator was shot in the chest. She's in the hospital. In other Iraq news, the Washington Post has revealed the CIA recruited and trained an Iraqi paramilitary group ahead of the U.S. invasion to conduct sabotage and help the CIA target buildings and individuals. The Iraqis were trained at 2 secret military bases in Jordan. The government's code name for the group was the Scorpions. After the invasion, the secret Iraqi force helped the U.S. carry out interrogations. The Post reports in one case in November 2003, members of the unit wearing masks and carrying clubs and pipes beat up an Iraqi general named Abed Hamed Mawhush in the presence of CIA and military personnel. That general died in U.S. custody 2 days later after a U.S. interrogator and military guard stuffed him in a sleeping bag, wrapped him in an electrical cord, and beat him. Hours after his death, U.S. military officials issued a news release stating the prisoner had died of natural causes after complaining of feeling sick. Army PSYOPs officers then distributed leaflets designed to convince locals that the general had cooperated and outed key insurgents. But now 2 Army soldiers with the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment in Fort Carson, Colorado, have been charged with the killing and are currently on trial. Documents released as part of the court proceeding have given the public a rare look at how interrogations were carried out in Iraq. Meanwhile, Polish Prime Minister Marek Belka has publicly criticized the U.S.-led efforts in Iraq. Belka said post-war nation-building in Iraq has failed totally. Belka said the U.S. and its allies made a mistake by basing its post-war plan for Iraq on the same model used for Germany after World War II. He said, quote, "It failed totally. Many mistakes, major mistakes, have been committed." In Saudi Arabia, ceremonies are being held today to mark the start of King Abdullah's reign. Vice President Dick Cheney is leading a U.S. delegation to pay tribute to the late King Fahd and to meet the new king. In London, police are reporting the number of religious hate crimes has soared by almost 600% since the July 7th bombings. Since that day, nearly 270 hate crimes have been reported in the city. During the same period last year, 40 were reported. Here in this country, a Marine sergeant has been charged with negligent homicide and other charges following the death of a Marine recruit. The recruit, 19-year-old Jason Tharp, died while taking part in a swimming exercise at Parris Island in South Carolina earlier this year. The day before he died, a local TV station happened to have videotaped the recruit being struck and grabbed by a Marine drill instructor, Staff Sergeant Nadia Lopez. 3 other Marines at the base face possible disciplinary action as well. In business news, a Chinese oil company has dropped its bid to buy the U.S. oil company Unocal. The move paves the way for Chevron to purchase the company. The bid by the China National Offshore Oil Corporation, known as CNOOC, marked the first major takeover bid by the Chinese government of a U.S. corporation. The Russian government has barred the U.S. TV network ABC from operating in the country after the network broadcast an interview with the Chechen warlord Shamil Basayev. The interview aired last week on Ted Koppel's Nightline. The Russian government called the broadcast a, quote, clear fact supporting the propaganda of terrorism. In Sudan, at least 71 people are now dead following the death of Sudan's Vice President John Garang. 800 more people have been injured in sectarian fighting. Garang died in a helicopter crash over the weekend. He's the former leader of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, which fought for more than two decades against the Islamic government in Khartoum. It was Africa's longest and costliest civil war. A peace agreement was signed in January 3 weeks ago. Garang was sworn in as Sudan's first vice president. In other news from Africa, troops in the nation of Mauritania have seized control of the state radio and television station and main routes into the capital. Presidential guards are said to have blocked off access to the presidential palace, and gunfire has been heard. The government says it foiled two coup attempts last year. And in election news in this country, Republican Gene Schmidt has won a special congressional election in southern Ohio, beating out Democrat Paul Hackett by a 52-48% margin. Hackett was attempting to become the first Iraq War vet elected to Congress. He had run on a platform highly critical of President Bush's handling of Iraq. Analysts had originally predicted that the Republican, Schmidt, would easily win, since no Democrat had come close to winning the House seat in decades. But Hackett nearly pulled off a major upset by losing by only about 3,500 votes. The Cincinnati Inquirer described Hackett's run as, quote, nothing short of astounding. And those are some of the headlines here on Democracy Now! As we turn now to Paul Hackett, joining us on the line from Cincinnati. While he did lose in Ohio, extremely close race, 52-48%, many are saying it was a huge victory, not only for Paul Hackett, but for the Democratic Party in a fiercely conservative district. No Democrat has won there for more than 30 years, with Republican victors often taking more than 70% of the vote. George W. Bush took more than two-thirds of the vote last November. Hackett's opponent, Gene Schmidt, is the head of Cincinnati Right to Life. Paul Hackett joins us on the line right now from his home in Cincinnati. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Oh, thanks so much for having me this morning. Not had too much sleep, but it's great to talk to you this morning.
Well, it's hard to say congratulations on your defeat, but it has astounded many. Can you talk about what happened and the platform that you ran on?
Well, I have to first confess that I did not sit around and, quote-unquote, come up with a platform. There are many issues that I believe in and believe very passionately in, and those issues, as they came up in the campaign, I shared with the citizens of the 2nd District. So it's funny when I hear the term platform, I sort of think as though that there was a committee that sat around and said, okay, this is what we believe on this. I mean, I just felt that in this district, there had not been a choice, there had not been an alternative, and that many like me were not being represented, our voices were not being represented regarding many issues in the U.S. government, foreign policy, to name a big one that was certainly spoken a lot about in the election campaign and so forth, and then many social issues as well. I mean, I'm just not happy with the state of politics in southern Ohio and frankly across the nation.
Well, Paul Hackett, let me ask you about Iraq, because that is what you are known for speaking out on. You have called George Bush the greatest threat to this country. Why?
I think any president, be he or she Democrat or Republican, who cultivates a sense that political dissent is unpatriotic is dangerous. And I believe that this administration has cultivated a almost a forgive me, I'm so tired. He's cultivated a sense that political dissent is unpatriotic, and that is completely un-American. Political dissent is what makes America great. It's what makes us the beacon of freedom and democracy, arguably, throughout the world. And all Americans should be frightened by any government that wishes to quell their public debate and opinions.
Paul Hackett, yesterday 7 Marines died in Iraq from Ohio. There were a lot of Marines out campaigning for you leading up to yesterday's election of Gene Schmidt. Can you talk about your reaction?
I actually received a phone call. It's the first time this has ever happened to me. I received a phone call from the family member of one of the Marines who was killed, which just blew me away. I was driving in my car, and my cell phone rang, and it's just a horrible tragedy. It's my Marines, some of my Marines who I was with in Iraq came to work with me. Marines from all over the United States and soldiers from all over the United States and other servicemen and women from all over the United States came to help me in this election as word spread of our campaign. And, I'm humbled. And to the chicken hawks out there that think that what I say about this administration is not representative to some large degree in the military, I say that this was only a shot over the bow. You'd better wake up and smell the coffee, because we are minting young Democrats day by day in Iraq. And maybe it didn't happen in this election, but it's going to happen in many elections in the future. And the only criticism that I heard about my comments regarding this administration are usually of those who have never served in the military. And a very, very small percentage of people have come up to me and said, I was in the military, that wasn't right. And usually then when I ask them, you ever been in combat, the answer is no. I have yet, and, I'm not asking, this is not an invitation, but I've yet to have somebody say, hey, I was in combat and what you said was wrong. That I've not heard. Almost unanimously, the word from the veterans that have contacted me by email, by telephone, and come to work with us in person have been overwhelmingly supportive. And so,
Paul Hackett, you've been very critical of President Bush and of the reasons for going to war, and yet you say that if your unit is called back, you're headed back to Iraq. Why?
Right. Well, look, I'm an American first. Those are my Marines over there who are fighting and dying, and I feel a bond with them, and I feel I need to be there with them. And I set my politics aside when I put the uniform on to be with, I really mean this, to be with my brothers and sisters in the Marine Corps. I mean, they are my second family that I've been with many years. So that's it. I mean, they need good leadership. I think I certainly try my best to provide that good leadership when I'm in uniform.
So you would return to fight a war that you think is unjust?
Well, I've not said that it's unjust. I've said that it's been mismanaged by the administration. I said that it was a poor use of our military. I'm not quite sure the implication of the label of unjust, so I'm uncomfortable using that. I've been critical of it up and down, but to me, that's not inconsistent with my desire to want to serve and my desire to want to lead Marines and be with them in the field.
How do you feel about people like Camilo Mejia? He's a Florida Army National Guardsman. He went to Iraq like you returned. He was supposed to return to his unit, but felt he just couldn't go back, that the war was unjust, and he didn't want to be a part of it. He also said he didn't want to be a part of the abuse at one of the detention facilities in Iraq. He was court-martialed, and he only recently came out of the brig, out of jail, after almost a year in detention. How do you feel about those who are saying no to war and are refusing to return?
Well, look, let me parse that out. If you're in the military and you wear the uniform, that's a choice that you've made. And if while in uniform you make the choice not to go back, you've made the choice to be court-martialed. So we're big boys and girls, accept the consequences of your choices. So how do I feel about it? Hey, he's an American. Those are his choices. He makes those choices. He lives with the choices that he's made. So I have no empathy and I have no sympathy, but I have no criticism of that. I don't know his case, so I take it on the facts that you presented to me. But, you know, hey, those are his choices, and, you know, more power to him. I mean, I'm assuming when he makes those choices, he knows the consequences.
Do you think the U.S. should get out of Iraq?
I'm not there yet. I think that, and let me step back and say, when you say, should the U.S. get out of Iraq? Yes, eventually, yes. The question is, are we going to do it tomorrow, or are we going to accomplish the bare minimum to allow the Iraqis to survive within their defined government and social structure? And right now, I don't think that any form of security force in Iraq is capable of providing that for the people. And while it may seem difficult to comprehend on this side of the world, at this point, I believe that Iraq will spiral out of control. And even though it's in a terrible condition today as a result of the insurgency phasing into civil war, perhaps, I don't think it's currently today as bad as it will be if we were to pull out tomorrow. I think that the administration has got to permit the American military over there to fight that fight and train the ISF, the Iraqi Security Forces, in a manner acceptable and acceptable to our military, which I argue they're not. The administration is not allowing that, so that the ISF can be up to speed and we can get out of there. I think that as a citizen of the United States, setting aside my uniform and so forth, I think we need to turn up the heat on the administration and demand some sort of oversight as citizens as to what successes the administration is having in training the Iraqi security forces.
Paul Hackett, one last question, and that is Jean Schmidt, the woman who won your opposition, Republican, is the head of Right to Life Cincinnati. What's your position on abortion?
Well, I think everybody by now knows I'm pro-choice, and I think that is the only choice. I mean, the very simple way I explain that is I don't need Washington, D.C. coming into my personal life, telling me, how to live my personal life or dictating to my wife what choices she makes with her doctor. And not only is that un-American, it's contrary to the Republican Party, as best known by perhaps Barry Goldwater. And I think it's wrong, and I think all Americans need to think very seriously about how much government intervention they want in their personal lives. And if you think it's just Terri Schiavo, or if you think it's just the abortion issue, think about Terri Schiavo and their family, and there is another perfect example of Washington intruding into private lives.
Terri Schiavo, Paul Hackett, we're going to leave it there, and I want to thank you very much for being with us. Paul Hackett, speaking...
Thanks so much for having me on your show.
Thank you. Paul Hackett speaking to us from Ohio. He lost a very closely watched congressional race in a heavily Republican area, lost by 52-48, has astounded many, not only in Ohio, but around the country. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to the constantly worsening situation in Iraq, reports out of Baghdad say 14 Marines and a civilian interpreter were killed when their vehicle struck an explosive just outside of Haditha in western Iraq. Meanwhile, seven Marines killed Monday west of Baghdad pushed the official U.S. military death count past 1,800. At least 39 U.S. soldiers have been killed in Iraq in the past 10 days alone, all but two of them in combat. Meanwhile, the Iraqi Defense Ministry says that since the beginning of April, more than 2,700 Iraqis have been killed. This comes as two very different pictures are being painted about Iraq, depending on who you talk to or what media you turn to. In recent days, the top commander in Iraq, General George Casey, said the U.S. could begin withdrawing some troops by spring of next year.
And I do believe that if the political process continues to go positively, and if the development of the security forces continues to go as it is going, I do believe we'll still be able to take some fairly substantial reductions after these elections in the spring and summer next year.
General Casey made his comments standing next to Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. This was the latest and perhaps most significant statement to come after weeks of buzz about a possible U.S. exit plan. But the way it's being spun by the Pentagon is that the withdrawal will come as the Iraq Army, police, and other so-called security forces assume more control of the security of Iraq. That's far from happening. In fact, these are among the most dangerous jobs in Iraq, with resistance fighters killing soldiers and police every day. And the security forces in the new Iraq are responsible for widespread human rights abuses and extrajudicial killings. Take the recent examples of groups of Sunni men arrested by Iraqi forces only to... Many Sunnis now assume that being arrested is the equivalent of being killed. Far from moving toward greater stability and calm, Iraq is continuing to get more and more bloody and chaotic. Some analysts believe the recent U.S. talk of pullout is happening because the U.S. is losing militarily in Iraq to multiple enemies, loosely called the insurgents or the resistance. Our guest today writes, civil war has already begun in Iraq. He says, quote, with the war stalemated, repeated deployments wearing down morale of U.S. troops and too few new recruits to maintain force levels, the Bush administration may be deliberately provoking civil war as its exit strategy. The goal is not so much to exit Iraq, but leave behind a skeletal military force that would maintain the network of permanent bases under construction throughout Iraq while maintaining access to massive oil deposits in the north and south. Breaking Iraq into a series of mini-states, a strategy being pushed by some White House allies in the media, is seen as one way to ensure these goals. Those are the words of Arun Gupta. He is editor with the Independent newspaper, the newspaper of the New York Independent Media Center. He has the center spread in the current issue of the paper called Bush's Exit Plan, Civil War. Arun Gupta, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
pushing a civil war?
Well, I think that if you look at the situation in Iraq, there are indications that this is what the Bush administration may be attempting, because the whole occupation has been a disaster from the beginning. The disbanding of the army and the security forces, the failure of reconstruction, effectively alienated the Sunni Arab population. And then since then, what we've seen, such as like the blatant theft of Iraq's oil money, the use of various militias, has increased the sectarian conflict. Now, at the beginning of the year, few people considered a civil war between Sunnis and Shiites a possibility. There has been a lot of speculation all along that between Sunnis and Turkmen and the Kurds, that it was a much greater possibility because the Kurds run their own state. But over the last 6 to 9 months, the political process has intensified the sectarianism in Iraq. Rather than bringing the country together, the elections that were held in January solidified the sectarian lines. That was because the U.S. pushed the strategy that parties should run on slates, that they should cobble together these large groupings. And because of the elections were held in this atmosphere of intense violence, very few parties could actually campaign in the open in much of the country. So what that meant was that most Iraqis who participated in the election voted their ethnicity, such that the Shiite slate, the United Iraqi Alliance, and the Kurdish slate walked away with most of the votes. Then after the election, the U.S. Pushed this strategy of parceling out government jobs according to ethnic quotas, you know, this kind of like 60-20-20, 60% Shiite, 20% Kurdish, 20% Sunni Arab. So you had the whole government divided essentially in the way that the Lebanese government is divided. So all these actions have added fuel to this sectarian strife. And as you pointed out, really the one of the major failures of the occupation has been the inability of the Pentagon, of the U.S. to, as they put it, stand up Iraqi forces. According to the Pentagon's own report, only 3 out of 100 military battalions, Iraqi military battalions, are capable of effectively conducting counterinsurgency operations on their own. So there's been a casting about for other strategies, and one of these has been to use pop-up militias, illegal militias, that have proliferated in Iraq over the last year. They have no accountability, really, to the government. They're run by individuals who are then folded into various security services. The proliferation is really stunning in terms of the number of different security forces. And then in April, with the ascension of the Shiites and Kurds into the government, the various ministries were parceled out, again, according to ethnicity. So the Shiites took the Interior Ministry, which has control of many of the most feared militias, such as the Special Police Commandos, the Wolf Brigades, the Lion Brigades, and the Kurds were given the Defense Ministry. And so they have been using their own militias allied with their parties against the insurgency. And so it's, what this is really doing is it's pushing the whole Sunni Arab population into the arms of the resistance, because they see, like, there's no middle ground. You know, if they don't want to support the resistance, they're going to be at the whim of these death squads. And now what we've seen since April is bodies turning up almost on a daily basis. It's often not clear, you know, are these Shiites, are these Sunnis throughout much of the country. According to a Christian Science Monitor report, since April alone, more than 1,000 people have been killed in Basra, where basically you have a theocracy that's come into power, where all these different Shiite factions, parties, and militias are vying for power. And according to the monitor, monitor, the vast majority are Sunni Muslim, that there's a lot of revenge going on in return for the repression of the Shiites during the rule under Saddam Hussein.
Arun, you write that according to a number of reports, the Interior Ministry's Wolf Brigades are behind many of the death squad killings on the Shiite side.
Yes.
Wolf Brigades?
This is one of the special forces that have been set up under the ministry. According to a number of reports, the Wolf Brigades, a lot of its commanders come from the Badr Brigades. The Badr Brigades are affiliated with SCIRI, the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. That was set up in Iran in the early 1980s during the Iran-Iraq War. It's not indigenous to Iraq. And SCIRI was one of the big winners in the election. And they said, well, we're disbanding the Badr Brigades. All they did was they changed the name. They now call it the Badr Organization. The head of the Interior Ministry, Bayan Sulab, is a member of the Badr Brigades. The head of the Badr Brigades, according to Patrick Coburn, is very influential in the Interior Ministry. And according to one report on the website, Jamestown.org, a lot of the commanders, something like 160 commanders in the Interior Ministry forces have been fired since April, and many of them have been replaced by Badr Brigade members. So what you're seeing is really the increase of this sectarian conflict. And, you know, Patrick Coburn, among others, writes how throughout Baghdad you can now see these militias openly traveling around, and they're considered the most effective of the security forces because their loyalty is to the parties, but they're unaccountable. According to human rights monitors, they're running networks of secret prisons where they're torturing and it looks like killing detainees. The head of the Wolf Brigades, Mohammed Qureshi, whose nom de guerre is Abu Walid, he is the mastermind behind the TV program Terror in the Grip of Justice, where they parade these alleged insurgents across a TV screen and they admit to all sorts of manner of crimes, you know, of killing, beheadings, where almost always they admit like that they have homosexual orgies because that's considered scandalous within Iraq. But a number of people who've appeared on these shows have later turned up dead with torture marks on their bodies. A number of people who've been freed from the Wolf Brigade detention centers have gone public and recounted how they were tortured, beaten, threatened with all sorts of potential atrocities, and forced into making these confessions. And a lot of the media reports of the TV show also indicate that the confessions seem very forced and convenient.
Many Sunnis assume if they're arrested, they're dead, killed by Shia police.
I think that's probably accurate at this point. I mean, part of the difficulty is getting the information. You know, it's like all these bodies are turning up. There are hundreds of bodies that are being found in rivers and lakes throughout Iraq. Nobody knows exactly where they come from. There are hundreds of bodies being unidentified bodies. Apparently, something like up to one quarter of the bodies that turn up in the Baghdad morgues are unaccounted for. And nobody knows exactly where they're coming from.
Finally, Arun, would you say the U.S. is losing right now?
It doesn't look good. That's certainly true. The Pentagon has been going around saying, well, the number of attacks are holding steady, about similar to a year ago. But their accounting is suspect, to say the least. In July of 2004, there were 47 attacks a day, according to their own statistics. As of July 2005, 25, it's up to 68 attacks a day. And I think what we've seen in the last few days is really grim news with the 21 Marines killed. Because what it shows is that the insurgency, despite the Pentagon spending literally billions of dollars on countermeasures, on armoring all the Humvees, has been unable to defeat this very simple technology of the improvised explosive device. And they're getting more powerful, more deadly, and they're able to circumvent the U.S. tactics.
Arun Gupta, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Editor of The Independent, the newspaper of the New York Independent Media Center. His piece in the current issue is called Bush's Exit, Civil War. And that's some of our coverage of Iraq today as we turn now to a story, two stories, two debates about whether the military is co-opting civil society in this country. As the U.S. military scrambles to meet recruiting goals, controversies emerging over a new initiative that allows members of the armed forces to join the Peace Corps to fulfill part of their 8-year service obligation. The new Pentagon Peace Corps partnership was established through legislation backed by Senators John McCain and Evan Bayh and passed 2 years ago by Congress. It's only now, though, that the military is heavily promoting the Peace Corps option to recruits through its National Call to Service program. 2007, we'll see the first batch of recruits will be eligible to participate in the Peace Corps after fulfilling a 15-month stint in the military. The program is part of the Individual Ready Reserve, which consists of active duty troops and trained military personnel who can be called up to active duty to fill vacancies. Founded in 1961 by President John Kennedy, the Peace Corps aims to, quote, promote world peace and friendship. Currently, more than 7,700 volunteers and trainees are enrolled in the program and serve in 72 countries around the world. Now, current and former participants are raising concerns that a direct tie to the Army will compromise the independence of the agency and potentially endanger participants by identifying them with U.S. military policies around the world. Peace Corps Director Gaddy Vasquez told the Washington Post that the agency was unaware of the National Call to Service program until it was already passed into law. We invited the Peace Corps on the show. They couldn't join us, but they did provide us with a statement of Vasquez where he says, quote, ultimately, the impact to Peace Corps in terms of how we recruit, who we accept into service remains very much intact and consistent with what we've done for 40 plus years. I'm an individual who embraces a very important facet of Peace Corps, and that's the Peace Corps independence as an agency within the executive branch. That a quote of the head of the Peace Corps, Vasquez. Well, yesterday, the Washington Post published an article on the Peace Corps option for military recruits, and we're joined on the phone by the author of that piece, Alan Cooperman. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you just lay out what it is you learned, and specifically, is it possible that the head of the Peace Corps didn't even know that this option was in place until now?
Well, what I learned was that this program has really been in effect for more than 2 years. The legislation was actually passed in 2002, but very few people in the Peace Corps seem to know anything about it. I contacted Peace Corps, current Peace Corps workers around the world. Virtually none of them had heard of it. I contacted a lot of Peace Corps former officials, well-known folks around the country, some of the founders of the Peace Corps. They were unaware of the details of this program, and many had no idea that the program even existed. And the reason is because it's really only now going into effect. Nobody has yet entered the Peace Corps through this route. Now, in all fairness to the sponsors of the legislation, it's clear, I think, that they intended this both to be a tool for military recruiting and, I think, in their minds, to be something good for the Peace Corps. I think that the idea was national service of all varieties, whether it be serving in New York City inner-city school as a teacher through AmeriCorps or in an African village through the Peace Corps or in the military, that all of those are valid forms of national service that should be honored and in some sense honored equally. And I think that that was the underlying intent of this legislation. But you are quite right that once word about it began to filter through the Peace Corps, and now it has begun to move very rapidly through the Peace Corps, quite a bit of concern is built up and I think growing opposition, and I think there are going to be moves to try to change the program legislatively.
Alan Cooperman wrote the piece on the Peace Corps Pentagon partnership in the Washington Post yesterday. We're joined in our Washington, D.C. studio by Kevin Quigley, who's head of the National Peace Corps Association, which represents former Peace Corps staff and volunteers. Your response, Kevin Quigley.
Well, Amy, first, good morning, and thank you for focusing attention on this important issue. And as Alan just said, this really isn't a partnership between Peace Corps and the Pentagon, because Peace Corps wasn't consulted when the legislation was developed. And also, I think the authors of the legislation, Senator McCain and Senator Bayh, had a good intention. As we heard in the earlier segment, Paul Hackett was talking about the importance of service and that it is one of our core American values. But we in the Peace Corps community believe very strongly that it's important to make a distinction between military service and Peace Corps service, as well as to maintain an independent Peace Corps. We think that's essential for the viability of the organization. And I would say this isn't really a partisan issue. Over the last few weeks, as this story has emerged, we've consulted widely in the Peace Corps community, including with former Republican directors of Peace Corps, and they also share our concerns about what impact this program is going to have on the independence of Peace Corps, and would it adversely affect the security of serving volunteers.
We're also joined on the telephone by Douglas Smith from the U.S. Army Recruiting Command in Fort Knox, Kentucky. We're going to go to break, and then we'll get his response. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we talk about the Peace Corps and the Pentagon. Joining us on the line, Alan Cooperman, who wrote the piece in the Washington Post, Kevin Quigley, National Peace Corps Association, and Douglas Smith from the U.S. Army Recruiting Command in Fort Knox, Kentucky. Your response to Kevin Quigley's concerns about the Peace Corps being partnered with the Pentagon?
Well, I have nothing to say about that. All I can tell you is that the National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2003 directed Department of Defense to implement this program across all the services. This is not just an Army program.
So can you tell us, Douglas Smith, when you're recruiting or when you have your people recruiting, do you say you can go to Iraq and to the Peace Corps after?
I don't know that we'd say it that way. We would explain that basically this program, whether you join the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, or whatever, you serve, first you go through your basic training and learn your particular military skill, then you serve 15 months on active duty, followed by 2 years of reserve service with a reserve unit among one of the military services, and then the remainder of your 8-year obligation can be spent either in the standby reserve or with a reserve unit or with the Peace Corps or AmeriCorps or a program of that sort.
Kevin Quigley, your response.
Well, we as I said a moment ago, we think it's very important to promote national service. We do think that there's a distinction between serving as a teacher in the United States as opposed to serving as a volunteer, where your very security and the success of your assignment is dependent on your being integrated into a host community. And also that there's been a long history, as I think Gaddy Vasquez points out in his letter or his statement, of Peace Corps volunteers who served honorably both in the military and in Peace Corps, but there was no formal linkage. This was an individual choice made by someone who'd served in the military, had been discharged, and then or was on independent ready reserve, and then at that point in time opted to apply to Peace Corps and was selected. What concerns the community is this formal linkage between a recruitment program that is encouraged, trying to encourage new recruits into our armed services, and with a formal linkage into the Peace Corps program.
Well, I wanted to bring in another guest, Stan Andrews. After the Washington Post article came out yesterday, we were contacted by the father of a Peace Corps volunteer who's about to leave for Africa. They didn't want to reveal the identity of their son, but said the Peace Corps had originally assigned him to a Muslim country just after stories of Quran abuse at Guantanamo had hit the news. He was concerned for his safety as an American, asked to be transferred to another country. Eventually, he was assigned to a country in Africa. We're joined on the line from Maine by the father of this young man. Stan Andrews is with us, a retired international research administrator. Can you express your concerns? And then we can get Douglas Smith's response from the U.S. Army Recruiting Command in Fort Knox.
Good morning, Amy. Thanks for having me on.
It's good to have you with us.
My main concern is as a parent, and basically I am concerned because when my son was first asked to serve in a Muslim country, this was right after we had the eruption from Newsweek and disclosures about the trashing of the Quran. And my son turned down the country primarily because it wasn't that he didn't want to serve, but he didn't want to have to be serving in a place where he felt he would be ineffective because he would be constantly having to try to defend our policies in Iraq and elsewhere. And then when the second opportunity came up, he's very happy about going over and serving. He's grown up in a Quaker household where we believe in service to community. And he's looking forward to this assignment. But the problem as parents that we have with this policy that's being implemented by the military right now is that it really puts the Peace Corps on a collision course with our military aspects of our foreign policy. And it also basically may have the effect of putting our children in harm's way because of this policy. I look back at the Peace Corps over many years, and my wife and I have always viewed the Peace Corps as an institutional treasure of how to transmit our values of democracy and freedom. The Peace Corps has survived several storms and maintained their institutional integrity during this period of time. And I can't imagine a worse type of scenario than for people overseas to presume that the Peace Corps is back to Camelot, back to the business of basically providing spies in various aspects of a country's development.
Stan, your wife was talking to our producer, Nell Geiser, and she said to her, first we kill them, then we teach them to read. Douglas Smith of the U.S. Army Recruiting Command at Fort Knox, your response.
My question has to be this. Are you saying that the Peace Corps does not want people who've served in the military ever in their lives? Is that what the Peace Corps is looking for, is exclude a whole segment of society from volunteering to serve in the Peace Corps? Because that's what this program is. The people who've enlisted through this program have the option of either staying with an Army Reserve unit or the reserve unit of the military service they enlist in, going into the standby reserve, or volunteering to be in the Peace Corps or AmeriCorps. So the attitude of some of your callers seems to be that the Peace Corps does not welcome anyone who has had military service, and I think that just sounds wrong to me.
Let's end with Kevin Quigley. Your response to Douglas Smith of the U.S. Army Command.
I'd like to say that there is a long tradition of many, many volunteers who've served both in the military service and in Peace Corps. The important distinction is that's an individual choice. They aren't recruited into the military with the formal option of participating in Peace Corps, providing an incentive, either a financial incentive of $5,000 or loan rebatements. And it's this creation of a formal program without the active involvement of Peace Corps, where without thinking of what the implications might be for the security of serving volunteers, is what is very problematic for the community. And we do hope to work with members of Congress to take a look at this and to see if we can address this legislatively in the very near term. Thank you.
Last comment to Stan Andrews, dad of the young man who's headed to Africa right now to be in the Peace Corps. Well, I'll put the question to then Kevin Quigley. It's interesting that the congressional legislation that was passed is passed by two, well, possibly potential presidential candidates, one Republican, one Democrat, Evan Bayh and John McCain. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would just echo my earlier comment that national service is a core value, as Stan Anderson talked about. It's something that's key for many communities. Paul Hackett spoke eloquently about it early in the program. And I want to be very clear that your viewers and listeners understand that the Peace Corps community embraces the concept of service. We just think that there is a very important distinction between military service, AmeriCorps service, and Peace Corps service.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. Kevin Quigley, President of National Peace Corps Association, Alan Cooperman, who wrote the piece in the Washington Post, and Douglas Smith, the U.S. Army Recruiting Command in Fort Knox, Kentucky. Stan Andrews also is on the line with us. His son headed to Africa in the Peace Corps. As we continue to look at this issue of the militarization of civilian institutions, we're going to turn now to academia. The Intelligence Authorization Act is an annual bill that allocates funds for intelligence agencies. When Congress passed the 2004 legislation and Bush signed it into law, the bill drew fire from many corners because it expanded the Patriot Act and was passed with little debate. But there's another provision in the legislation that received almost no attention. Section 318 of the bill appropriated $4 million to fund a pilot program called the Pat Roberts Intelligence Scholars Program, or PRISP. The program is named after Kansas Republican Senator Pat Roberts, chair of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. The scholarship was created in order to train intelligence operatives and analysts at U.S. universities for careers in the CIA and other agencies. Students get up to $50,000 over a two-year period and are required to complete at least one summer internship at the CIA or other approved agencies. The program's veiled in secrecy, no public list of participants, no requirement they disclose their affiliation to their professors. David Price has written an article in Counterpunch entitled "The CIA's Campus Spies." He writes that he tried to obtain more details about the program, but the CIA spokesperson was reluctant to discuss them. Price says the agency did confirm that, quote, PRISP now funds about 100 students who are studying at an undisclosed number of universities, but they refuse to identify which campuses are hosting these covert scholars. Well, we are joined now by David Price from Washington State. He's in Olympia, professor of anthropology who teaches at St. Martin's University, also author of the book Threatening Anthropology, McCarthyism, and the FBI Surveillance of Activist Anthropologists. And we're joined by the man who was involved in the creation of these scholarships, Felix Moose, joins us from Kansas, professor of anthropology who teaches at Kansas University. PRISP is largely his brainchild. He brought the idea forward for the program to his Senator Roberts. Let's first go to Professor Moose. Your idea for this, and specifically for anthropologists.
Yes.
Can you explain why you feel this is so important? And also, if you could talk about the secrecy of the program, professors perhaps not knowing that their students are receiving money from the CIA.
Well, the initial idea was that we desperately need people who are competent in foreign languages and areas, which we don't have. As you probably are aware of, we have far too few interpreters in any government agencies. We have far too few American intellectuals who speak foreign languages. And therefore, I thought that to have more analysts that are competent in foreign languages and areas was a good idea. It had nothing to do with secrecy. I've never argued that we should introduce spying into American academe. I've been a university professor for more than 44 years, and certainly I'm not for secrecy or classified activities that cannot be openly discussed. But what I wanted to do is to open a dialogue among anthropologists of the changed world in which we find ourselves.
David Price, you too are a professor of anthropology. Your response.
Oh, good morning, Amy. My response is that secrecy is definitely becoming a part of this program and the other programs that are coming along with it. And what we're seeing now is a very dramatic shift in funding for graduates and undergraduates in the social sciences and other fields that want to do international study. In the past, we had programs like Fulbright or Title VI that gave students money to study foreign languages on their own, you know, a number of which have always gone to work for the State Department, intelligence agencies, and so on. In the 90s, we saw a shift with the development of programs like the National Security Education Program, which was very controversial, and had sort of soft payback requirements where students would later go and be asked to at least look for employment in national security agencies. Now, with the development of the Pat Roberts Program and another program called the Intelligence Community Scholars Program that's just coming online, we have sort of indentured scholarship where from the front end there's pre-loyalty where people who are going to work for intelligence agencies are brought aboard with the understanding that, you know, people won't know who they are, and then later throughout they'll go through their education process, and then later they'll go and be doing intelligence work. Mike, one of my many concerns is that this will inevitably limit and dumb down the type of intelligence that's gathered and the analysis that happens, because you'll only have a select group of people who, going into the process, are already thinking in very limited ways.
Professor Felix Moose.
Yeah, I think the concerns by David, with whom I have spoken at many occasions, both publicly and privately, are completely misplaced, because I seriously doubt that a program that funds 100 or so individuals in a university system that includes at least 2,000 institutions of higher learning are going to subvert American academe. The thought that this would dumb down intelligence operations is completely misplaced, because we need more people who speak languages and know foreign areas to experience, rather than only academics teaching in universities. And therefore, I would argue that rather than accuse one side or the other by being bending the truth, we should have a dialogue of how to educate a new generation of anthropology students within the United States that know a lot more about the world than they do.
David Price, the issue of secrecy, and we only have a few seconds to go, but the fact that the professors don't even know if their students are on the CIA payroll?
That's not true. That's not true. The Pat Roberts Scholarship Program does not force individuals to any secrecy. If the critics of the Pat Roberts program would contact Senator Roberts' office for information, that
the interesting thing is, of course, there's secrecy. Not a single participant in this program has come forward.
Well, I'm going to leave it there because we have to wrap up the show. But I do want to ask people to email us at mail@democracynow.org. with their concerns and questions, and we'll put them to you for a discussion later. I want to thank you both for being with us. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.